Hello, everyone. I'm Mike's mom, and you are listening to Thinking Outside the Long Box. On this episode, the boys will talk about the history of Luke Cage, Captain America, Nexus, and Lobo. Please subscribe to this podcast.
Hi, everybody, and welcome once again to Inside the Long Box. No bags, no boards, just comic books. My name is Thomas Strange, and with me, as always, is my good friend Mike Manning. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing excellent this week. How are you, Tom?
Excellent. Thank you very much for asking. How you doing over there in Boston, Tommy?
I'm doing fine, Tommy.
Boston Tommy is doing fine. We're excited this week because it's one of my favorite characters of all time, Luke Cage, better known as Power Man. This week, I'll be explaining the history of Power Man, and then we're going to talk about some of our favorite issues and stories, and then we'll get into our spotlight on older comics that LT is going to talk about, spotlight on newer comic books that my good friend Mike is going to talk about, and then some historically significant comic books. And then, of course, plugs, and that'll be the end of the podcast, so we can all go out drinking at our favorite bars, because that's really all we're trying to do by the end of this. Does anyone have anything they want to say before we get started today?
I would just like to thank Kirby Crackle, the geek rock band that has offered to let us use their music in our podcast. So if you haven't been to KirbyCrackle.com, I suggest you go, or even better, go to iTunes and buy their music.
I bought all their stuff just to show my support for the geek comic world. Tommy, anything new going on in Boston?
Not much. I'm actually not in Boston right now. I'm in Florida this week, but I'll be back in Boston next week.
Well, we'll be talking about Florida at the end of the show when we talk about plugs, but now we're going to get right into the comic book character of the week, Luke Cage, better known as Power Man. Now, as anyone who knows me knows, and I am fascinated by this character, just to give you a little quick background on why I'm so fascinated by this character, when I grew up, my uncle gave me a large stack of comic books. They all just happened to be bought at a tag sale. He didn't know it was in the bag. It was mostly Luke Cage. I grew up thinking Luke Cage was like the biggest superhero of all time. So I have kind of a skewed idea of the Marvel Universe when I was a kid. People would ask me if I like Batman or Superman, and I'd say, I don't know, does he ever help Luke Cage? And you'll often see me cosplaying as Luke Cage at various comic book conventions. Like I said, one of my favorite comic book characters of all time. Now, one of my favorite parts about Luke Cage is that Luke Cage isn't even his real name. His name is Carl Lucas, and this was Marvel's attempt to cash in on the black exploitation film craze that was going on in the 70s. So Carl Lucas, a low-level drug dealer and kind of heavy in a Hell's Kitchen-type scenario, was framed by his good friend for a drug deal that gone wrong. Now, he goes to prison for this. Now, of course, the hero's journey often starts with the bad guy making his way back into the good guy role, and that's exactly what happened here. Carl Lucas goes to prison, and he doesn't get along with the inmates because he's not a bad guy, and he doesn't get along with the prison guards because the system is very corrupt. One prison guard takes a real offense to him and makes his life a living hell. To get out of prison, he volunteers for an experiment to do a new super soldier formula. This super soldier formula is very much like the Captain America formula. It's going to be conducted on prisoners, though, so just in case there's ever any, you know, accidental deaths or anything, it's only prisoners. This kind of brings in a lot of social justice themes in some of the things I talk about. During the experiment to give him superpowers, why would you give prisoners superpowers, by the way? It doesn't sound like a great idea. The guard that hates Luke Cage tampers with the equipment, trying to kill him. Now, the machine explodes. Luke Cage gains superpowers, but of course, all the machines destroyed, and no one really knows exactly how it worked because it was the tampering and the explosion all mixed together that made Luke Cage super powerful. He escapes from Blackgate Prison, I'm sorry, Seagate Prison, and makes his way back to his old neighborhood. He needs a secret identity, and he decides on the name Luke Cage. The cage part is to remind himself that he was put in a cage and he never wants to go back. Now, the iconic yellow and blue pants and the chain is a great story, so I'm going to tell it very quickly. He goes into a costume shop to buy a superhero outfit. He can't afford to buy anything. So he asks, what's in that trunk over there? And it's an old magician's trunk. Inside, of course, is some escape artist stuff, which is the big chain that he wears around his waist and the cuffs that are on his wrists, and the yellow disco-type magician shirt. He's like, I'll take this. And that's how he came to be Luke Cage, Power Man, in that iconic uniform. And that, in a nutshell, is Luke Cage's origin story. I don't want to get too deep into it because, believe me, my friends will tell you this, I will talk for hours about this. So instead of doing that, let's talk about some of our favorite storylines. I'll start with my good friend Mike Manning.
All right. Well, I never got to read Luke Cage as a kid, probably because your uncle bought all of them or whoever had that tag sale was buying all the issues. So my first experience with Luke Cage is actually my favorite comic that he's involved in, and that's in Daredevil number 178. It came out in January of 1982. It was written and drawn by Frank Miller with Klaus Janson as the inker. And I like the storyline a lot because although Luke Cage only has a minor part in it, it was my first introduction to him. The basic story is Foggy Nelson is afraid that bad guys are going to hurt Matt Murdock, so he hires Heroes for Hire, Luke Cage and Iron Fist, to guard Matt Murdock, which infuriates Matt Murdock, who we all know is the Daredevil, because he can't become the Daredevil with these two guys guarding him, so he's always trying to slip away from him. It's really funny. But not only that, it being really funny is kind of a twist for the normal Frank Miller Daredevil stuff. But in that comic, it also has J. Jonah Jameson. It's got the Kingpin. It's got Elektra, along with, of course, Danny Rand, Iron Fist, and, of course, Luke Cage, Power Man. So I like it. I love the whole Frank Miller run, and that was my favorite Luke Cage story, although I did love the New Avengers that came out in, like, around 2005 when he was one of the leaders of that group. But that's my favorite story.
All right, next we'll talk to my good friend Tommy B. Tommy B. in Florida, what's your favorite Luke Cage story?
My favorite Luke Cage story was Luke Cage number 2. When Doc Bernstein basically tells Luke Cage that he knows who he is and that if he doesn't stay on the straight and narrow, that he's going to turn him in. I like this for a number of reasons because it really kind of highlights the time period in the 70s when this was going on, where there was this distrust between the two races. And it kind of brought that to the forefront where Doc Burstein is like, I'm giving you a second chance, Luke Cage, but you ain't getting a third.
An excellent point. And that was a great comic book. That was a terrific one and seminal in the series, I thought. Really brought it together. My favorite is a run where Luke Cage is in the Defenders, and that's called the Son of the Serpent run. And that is, let me bring that up so I know exactly what I'm talking about here. That is the Defenders issues 22 through 25, called the Sons of the Serpent. And basically, Nighthawk finds out that one of his companies is buying up a lot of property in some very disreputable neighborhoods, and those neighborhoods are starting to burn down. And it turns out that a race group, very much like the KKK, called the Sons of the Serpent, are actually behind it, and they're burning down the ghettos, trying to get African Americans to move to the suburbs. They believe that if African Americans move to the suburbs, it'll start a race riot. What actually happens is the writers very cagely, no pun intended, get the white crowds to start siding with the African Americans who are having their houses burned down. And they do it subtly and they do it slowly. You can actually see the crowds moving away from not in my neighborhood to, well, of course they have to live somewhere, and why are these guys burning down their neighborhoods? And one of the great parts about this is the Sons of the Serpent were actually run by an African-American financier who worked for Nighthawk, who didn't want to start a race war at all. He just was doing a land fraud scheme. When Luke Cage found this out, he, for the first time ever, utters a racial slur. He calls him an Oreo. And, of course, I, not being African-American, had to ask around with some of my friends, how bad is being called an Oreo? And my good friend Mr. Wendell said, Tom, that's pretty bad. So I guess it's pretty bad to be called an Oreo. It's one of the great comic books, great series. It does one of the things that I think is very stereotypical when China shows poverty, and something I've written about in the past called Rat in the Baby Crib. Every time a white artist or a white writer wants to show poverty in the inner city, they like to show a rat sitting in a baby's crib. I've seen it in about 20 different films and about 30 different comic books. It's one of those tropes that doesn't seem to want to go away, and it does make an appearance here. About all I want to say about that. Go read that comic book run. It is terrific.
And another great thing about that storyline is that the Sons of the Serpent really were pretty much against all of the different races, and most of the different religions were also brought up. I mean, they were just really against everything that was not white America.
And there was a very narrow definition of white American. I think at one point someone said something about their Protestant cousin, and the guy goes, "You got a Protestant cousin? Protestants aren't white." And like a couple guys turned on him like, "I'm Protestant." It was like funny for a second, but also very telling about what the writers were trying to say.
And it plays into the whole Sons of Serpent. There's a continuing storyline amongst Marvel Comics. Whenever they use them, they're always being used by somebody else for another purpose. Apparently, these racists are very easily duped into doing other people's bidding.
So not the smartest snakes in the snake hatchery. All right, now we're going to move into the next segment, which is called What to Read or Recommendations. This is handled by my good friend Mike. Mike, what's new in the long box?
Oh, well, at the front of my long box this week is Sam Wilson, Captain America. I'm going to highly recommend this for a few reasons. First, the writer Nick Spencer is hilarious. If you didn't read his run on the sinister foes of Spider-Man, I highly recommend it. He's also doing great work on the Astonishing Ant-Man, but Captain America is really standing out for me. And one of the reasons behind it is people are losing their minds because of the Sons of the Serpent, who appear in the very first issue. I don't want to spoil the surprise, but as always, they are being used by somebody to accomplish something totally different from what they think they're doing. But it's very funny, it's engaging, and it really is establishing Sam Wilson as his own Captain America, not living in the shadows of Steve Rogers, because he's got conflicts with Steve Rogers in this. But it also shows the great friendship that goes on between Steve Rogers and Sam, so that way they can show, even though they don't agree on everything, friendship is about more important than how people feel politically. So I really like it. I highly recommend it.
I just want to jump in one quick thing here. I never thought Sam Wilson, I never thought the Falcon was just Captain America's sidekick. There were way too many comic books where Captain America explicitly says, "You're not my sidekick, we're friends." And a lot of comic books where it's easily shown that they're equal. So the whole, you know, Sam Wilson was always a sidekick always kind of bothered me. How about you, Mike?
It did, actually. And when I first started reading Captain America back in, I guess it was the early 80s, when it was, or maybe the late 70s, Captain America and the Falcon. The Falcon was not his sidekick. It was definitely his partner throughout that whole series, the run that I remember reading as a kid. And I always viewed the Falcon as his partner, not as a sidekick or anything. In fact, in the last series that they had with Sam Wilson as Captain America before they just restarted a few months ago, that was one of the things the villains used to do slurs at him, like Batroc the Leaper was like, "No, I do not fight sidekicks."
Batroc had a point.
But he does have a point, but he's wrong. Sam's
but he was wrong.
Sidekick.
I'm sure, actually, we're probably going to do a Sam Wilson one in the coming episodes, because Sam Wilson's a great character, and so much to get into with him, too, especially with the retcons and everything else.
I always viewed the Hawk as the sidekick.
Red Wing?
Falcon, the Falcon's Hawk, Red Wing, I always thought he was definitely the sidekick.
I don't think Red Wing...
Red Wing did nothing but take orders. That's all I'm saying.
That's an we should have got him like a little pair of the blue shorts or something. He's going to be a sidekick. All right, so now we're going to go to the back of the long box, and we're going to talk about a series that's been maybe ignored. LT, what do you find at the back of that long box today?
I want to talk about Nexus today. Nexus was a great comic book that was put out in 1981 by First Comics, and it featured Mike Baron writing and Steve the Dude Rude as the artist, and it was just a great series. The general premise was that the basic premise was that Nexus, his mother and father, fled a planet, and in doing so, his father killed a decent portion of the population on the way out, and they found an abandoned civilization on a distant planet that they were able to live on, and they lived there, and Nexus started having basically health problems, and he was put into a tank that kind of restored him. And what really was going on is that the dead aliens from the planet were imbuing Nexus with superpowers, and they would basically force him by having voices in his head, driving him crazy, giving him headaches, commanding him to kill different dictators who are mass murderers. And he would have these voices in his head until he did it. And the first person that they had him kill was his father. And then after that, they had just people that were responsible for atrocities he would hunt down and kill. And that was his basic job. He had to do this in order to relieve the pain in his head. And the story really got a bit more complex in that after dictators were taken out, there would be refugees that would follow him back to his planet and basically live there as refugees. And he wanted no part of setting up a political system, so he had them all kind of govern themselves. He had very few rules for them. He didn't want any weapons. He didn't want basically any killing, et cetera, and so forth. And it was just a great story that basically touched on a lot of different political views and presented a lot of new ideas. The artwork, the cover art was amazing. Steve Rude used to do these painted covers for it, and it was just a fantastic tale. Anybody else have thoughts on Nexus?
Well, I never read Nexus.
I picked up one of the issues, won in an Eisner Award, and I got to say, for anybody who's going to go back and read any of these issues, you have to keep in mind at the time when it was written, the Soviet Union was the major threat to the U.S., and it is very heavy anti-communist. That's the best way I can describe it. So if you're not looking at it from the point of view of the time it was written, you might be like, this doesn't make much sense to me. But I agree with you. It is very apropos to read something like that now when, he is dealing with refugees, which is something that's been in the news a lot lately.
All right. Well, speaking of historical context, that leads into my segment, Historically Significant Comic Books. And today I want to talk about one of my new favorite things in the world, Lobo Comics by Dell Comics. I've always been a fan of Lobo. Now I'm not talking about DC, the main man Lobo. I'm talking about an African-American cowboy that was published by Dell Comic Books. This goes all the way back to the 1960s, first published in 1965. September of 1966 was the last issue. They only printed two. The reason they only printed two is because the mostly white owners of soda shops and places where comic books were sold didn't want an African-American comic book, and they certainly didn't want an African-American cowboy comic book. Many of these were just sent straight back to Dell Publishing, where they were pulped. Finding good copies of this is extremely rare. Finding reader copies, as I like to call them, or copies that you can actually sit down and read, isn't that hard. You can find some for 10 or 20 bucks, and I do recommend that you buy them. So Lobo's character very much follows the vein of the Lone Ranger. He's a gunslinger who was a fighter during the Civil War. He takes as his totem the wolf, and he has a gold coin with a wolf image and the letter L printed on him that he leaves at the site of some of his when he brings in some bad guys, or if there's like a, you know, the culmination of an adventure, he'll leave this coin behind. He got these coins and a lot of gold when he saved a miner from some mine claim jumpers who were trying to kill him. So he's rich. He has a signature gun, and he leaves a signature token behind. This is very much like a superhero set in the Old West. Now, one of the things that makes this so exciting for me is that I just recently found out that the real Lone Ranger, or the Lone Ranger character, was based off of a African-American ex-Civil War soldier named Bass Reeves, who was a slave who lost a poker game to his master, got mad about it because he found out his master was cheating, punched his master, and then fled to the Apache territory, not wanting to be hung. He lived among the Apaches, learned their ways, and became a lawman. He is an amazing, amazing character. Read as much about Bass Reeves as you can. 6'2", but not beyond dressing up as a woman or as a beggar to infiltrate bad guys' hideouts and bring in. He is credited with bringing in over 3,000 bad guys. He had a signature gun. He often wore disguises. He is credited by the creators of the Lone Ranger as one of the things that they based him off of. Now, the Lone Ranger is one of the things that all superheroes in America are based off of. So when you think about it, all superheroes in America can draw some of their lineage back to an African-American ex-slave. As a guy who loves writing about civil rights and social justice movements in comic books, this is my holy grail. I'm so happy to find this guy. And it's so much fun to read about. He was such an amazing character and just an awesome, awesome bit of comic book history and legend. All right, and that brings us to our very final segment, plugs and thanks. And one of the big plugs that we have this week, Mikey, do you want to talk about Pensacon?
Yes, coming up in February, I believe it is the 9th, 10th, and 11th of February. Pensacon is going on down in Pensacola, Florida, and we will have four different panels. That's right, four panels. If you like listening to our podcast and can't get enough of our sweet melodic voices, come on down. Or if you can get enough of our sweet melodic voices, come on down anyways and hear us out. We will be doing a panel on horrible stereotypes in comic books, which is one of my favorites. Of course, we will be doing the civil rights and social justice in comic books, which Tom was nice enough to bring us in on, which started the whole comic historians. We also will be doing a... What's the one that you just created, Tom?
This is a great new one, I think, and it's going to be a lot of fun. It's called Civil Disobedience as Reflected in Comic Books. And we're going to show how civil disobedience movements such as strikes, riots, protests, marches, or simple acts of civil disobedience such as in Civil War, not registering as a superhero, have been portrayed in comic books. And where writers and politics kind of fall in line in where one should align themselves, with the government or with protesters. As Captain America once very famously said, sometime if the entire world is wrong, it's up to you to put your back to the river of truth, stand like a tree and say, no, you move. That's a little wordy, but that's exactly what I want to say every time someone tells me I'm wrong about something socially or politically.
All right, and our fourth panel is going to be the Lex Luthor Was Right, Dissecting the Kryptonian Menace That Is Amongst Us, where I will be telling everybody how evil Superman is. Not only is he an illegal alien here in the United States, but he has been stealing superhero jobs and reporter jobs from hardworking Americans. And Tom will, of course, attempt and fail to stand up for Superman.
Yes, defending the most moral and righteous character in all of the pantheon of superheroes. How can I possibly win?
Murder Zod.
He didn't murder Zod.
I just got to say that I kind of side with Mikey on this one, so it'll be interesting.
We will be picking 12 tried and true people from the audience to act as an impartial jury. If you're wearing a Superman t-shirt, you'll probably be disqualified. And if anyone in your family was directly killed by the battle with Zod, once again, I'll have to qualify you from the jury for that, too.
So what happens if you're wearing a Luther t-shirt?
I have no problems with that.
I think I might have a qualm with that. We're also going to be going down to the New Orleans Comic-Con, which we've done for the past 3 or 4 years. And we have a couple other in line, recording, also including one here in Memphis, Tennessee. Very excited about that, my hometown. Tommy, anything else to add?
I would like to plug the documentary, Rude Dude, about Steve Rude. It highlights one of the big issues that's going on in America. Basically, Steve Rude is an artist. He does not have very good health insurance. He suffers from mental illness. He's bipolar, and it kind of highlights some of the difficulties that's created in his life, in his art, in his ability to keep making comics on a regular basis, and jobs lost because he can't keep deadlines. It's just a fascinating documentary about one of the people that, is responsible for what we do. And that being said, support your local artist. Commission works for them, from them. Buy stuff. That's how they live.
Buy stuff. I always say that. Buy stuff. There's plenty of great free comics online. One thing that we might start talking about is some of the free comic books we do like online. That's a podcast for another time, of course. But buying comics is the best way to support. I just want to thank everyone who tuned in today. Does anyone have any last thoughts? I got one last thought myself. Mike? All right. As always, I just like to say, it's whoever is home playing the drinking game. This week, every time anyone says the word basically, because that kind of came up a lot, and every time any of us say, do a shot, and I'll see you in the emergency room, because it'll happen a lot. Have a great night, everyone. Thanks again for listening.
That's basically episode 2.
Good ad. I hate you.
Friday night, did the moon's full glow. I was out at the club with the music thumping. Over Thundera, Gray Malkin Lane, as the bass bumped off the side of Snake Mountain. Jim on the stage with the hologram girls. Next up, Alison Blair to light the start of a night at the bar at the end of the world that my mind can't erase.